double carry, you know, 20, 30 tons. They said geosynchronous orbit if they wanted to. And their third stage will be from Blue Origin. That would be a liquid stage, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that there's so many big rockets being planned. A lot of smaller ones, but there's a lot of bigger ones on the drawing board. Many more Russians have the Angara. We have the, United Launch Alliance, the new Vulcan rocket being built, which will eventually replace the Atlas V many years from now. So, a lot of things going on that 5-10 years from now, you're going to see a lot of big rockets going up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2RIWWS doing. And if not, anybody have any questions? By the way, you mentioned the rocket that's going to be deorbiting into the Saturn Cassini. Got an email from Mike, and he had the, I think he sent it to you as well. You know, K1MJM, he sent it. And I looked at that. There's a, I guess, must be a 40-minute story, you know, NASA conference, or I guess news conference, all about that topic. And then they had maybe a 3-minute video, a couple minute video on the demise of Cassini, which was great. So Mike's listening. Thanks for that. Dick, over to you.
Yes, I did get that. There's another interesting report that was published this week about the ELMA, Altacomer Large Millimeter Array in northern Chile. I don't know how many dishes it consists of, but a whole bunch of millimeter and submillimeter radio telescope dishes all combined as a great big array called ALMA, A-L-M-A. And this is the week in which they're going to turn it on as a worldwide interferometer. There are two or three or four other millimeter wave radio telescopes around the world, and they're going to combine all of those telescopes starting this week, and they hope to be able to resolve the black hole that's in the middle of our galaxy, the Cygnus black hole, by way of all the extra resolution they can have. The nice thing about millimeter waves is they penetrate the dust you've got in the center of our galaxy, so even though you can't see that black hole optically, by way of millimeter wave radio telescopes, you can. Let me drop one. In order to do this, these worldwide sites are all going to be looking at the same direction at the same time on the exact same frequency, and they're going to be gathering data at 8 gigabits per second on each of these sites. In order to record the data that fast, each of the sites are going to be using four individual state-of-the-art hard drives or recording all of that data. And the total amount of data they're going to get out of this radio astronomy run is so large that to transmit that data back to the common site where it's going to be analyzed would take forever. What they're literally going to do is to ship the hard drives themselves all back to the same spot. So sometime in the next few months, I'm guessing, we'll get the first beginning of this data. They've perfected a couple of techniques by which you can make sure that all the telescopes are phase-wise and frequency-wise synchronized, even though they're widely distributed. You know, they're all mounted on planet Earth. When you get this huge array, this worldwide millimeter wave phased array, all humming correctly, you're going to get ridiculously tight resolution, and you'll be able to resolve a black hole at something like 30,000 light years, I think, is the center of our galaxy. So that article, I originally found it from Electronic Component News, and it's entitled Seeing Black Holes and Beyond. And I could give you the email address, but it's a great big long one. But maybe with just that information alone. I wonder if you've heard anything about this one, Paul. Looks like another exciting project. Can you imagine being able to really see, for the first time, a black hole? WS2M, K2RI,
repeater, timeout.
Yeah, I saw that somewhere. And we were trying to, the title was Resolving a Black Hole. But I didn't get a chance to look through that yet. And I don't remember what site it was on. Might have been on space.com. They always have things like that. But I know there was a millimeter array they were building down in Australia and also South Africa. They were going to test that. A couple of 100 antennas. Their ultimate goal is like up 3,000 antennas. But is this part of that system? You know, Dick? Back here.
I think it is, Paul. I think there's an array in Australia, an array in Africa. I think it's an array in Europe. And the Al Tacoma array is in South America. And I think there's even something in the United States. When you combine all of them with proper phasing, with this very broadband 8 gigabits per second, I think it merely means that they're, the instantaneous bandwidth of the radio telescope is going to be 8 gigahertz. And when you can make that all line up-wise, phase-wise, and recently projected some, they recently perfected some size, some software that allows them to do that. When it all is humming correctly, you'll be getting a picture that's equivalent to the whole darn Earth being one great big large phased array at millimeter wave frequencies. So therefore, that big an antenna, one common antenna, will give you the ability to resolve the black hole itself, to see what all the stuff looks like that's circling that black hole. Who do you pull? K2RIW.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, okay. About 10 years ago, I remember they started with this. Then they had to stop. The funding dried up. And I guess they started up again. At the time, they were saying it's all going to be hooked up through interferometry. Some complex thing, and they had to figure out the timing because, you know, you have a round Earth and it's going to be different by the time the signal, you know, hits, let's say, a low point in Australia, you know, or Africa might be closer to the whatever they're detecting. And they said this was once they figured out how they were going to do that, they'd be able to link all these things together, so you would have equivalent of an antenna that was, you know, as wide as the Earth. And then they went one step further, eventually thinking about putting these things in space, and then you can put them, like, you know, millions of miles apart. I guess they've gotten to the point where they want to try this. When is this going to start? And why can't they send the data? I mean, you know, they have high speed there. You know, internet in these places. What's the problem with the internet? They can't send it through. It's not fast enough. And also, there's another thing. They're going to have people, I don't know if they plan on doing this, people, just the general public, you can download an app and help try to look through through the data. I don't know if that was, you know, if that's part of the program, too. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's another YouTube video that I saw this week where you can take the raw data from Kepler, where the Kepler was using a computer program to find all of those exoplanets. However, when volunteer human beings use their eyesight scanning the data, they can find things that the computer program did not find. And they have found a number of unusual planets, exoplanets, by way of human volunteers looking at the raw Kepler data. So there's a YouTube video showing that. But when it comes to this ALMA array plus all these other worldwide millimeter wave radio telescopes being combined, What's complicated about the problem is that they're all looking at a common point in space, the center of our galaxy where the black hole is. Let me drop. It takes a complicated computer program to calculate what is the differential phase shift. If one of those worldwide sites is looking at the black hole, and that black hole is on sunrise to them, they're getting a positive Doppler shift because they're moving toward the black hole. The other side of the Earth is going to have a radio telescope that's looking at it at sunset, so to speak. They're going to have a negative Doppler shift. And this is not just a two-dimensional problem. It's a three-dimensional problem. The center of our galaxy is not on the equator. It's at some crazy elevation. It's at some crazy angle of right ascension and declination. And we're on a Earth that is moving around the sun. And the Earth is simultaneously rotating. So you've got to take out, the computer program has to take out all of those phase shifts. Because in order to make a very large phased array, you have to keep track of the instantaneous phase. So there is 1 or 2 degrees, I'm guessing, of the millimeter wave signal. I don't know the exact frequency, but I'm going to guess it's around 100 to 150 gigahertz. Let me drop. We're talking about millimeter and submillimeter wave length. So each time you move a millimeter, you're moving 360 degrees. You've got to take that all out. So you've got to have differential positional accuracy, to a very small fraction of a millimeter at each of these sites, on each of the dishes on the site, in order to make the phone come out right. The data itself is being recorded at each site at something like 8 gigahertz of bandwidth, and it's all being digitized. I'm guessing it's being digitized to something like 20 bits. So 20 bits of amplitude resolution of 8 gigahertz of instantaneous bandwidth, all being properly phase shifted, you're getting many petabytes and exabytes of data, which is being recorded at each site on 4 simultaneous hard drives. The total amount of data in those hard drives would take you weeks to transmit it through any kind of internet-like operation or satellite operation. They're going to be flying the hard drives themselves to a common place in order to process the data. I think the common place is either MIT or the, I think it was MIT. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
I'm sure that's going to be big news. It'll be on all the sites and magazines. So I look forward to the results. I'm just wondering what they're going to do after that. I mean, the black hole in the center of the galaxy, we have a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy. That the goal right now, just is that going to be their calibration? And then after that, they'll look at other galaxies and look for more black holes, or, supernovas. Or wonder what the long-term goal is for this. And, tying up all these locations all the time for this, this type of science and astronomy. Are they going to do this just once in a while, or all the time, or what do you know about that
thing? I'm guessing it's once in a while, Paul, because the United States, NASA, European Space Agency, I can't even think of the name of the European Southern Observatory. The ALMA is at the European Southern Observatory. So you've got all these major worldwide organizations who built these individual millimeter wave radio telescopes. So they each got to their goals, but periodically they're all going to be hooked together like this. I'm guessing for a couple of days at a time. Continuously, not a chance. There's not enough hard drives in the world to run that kind of a system simultaneously forever. But the closest major black hole, I think, that we know about is the one that's in the center of our galaxy. Something like 30,000 light years away. And so to completely resolve it and all the stuff around it could be extremely interesting. Once you perfect the technique, and there's going to be some bugs worked out of it, you talk about that many kinds of simultaneous motion within each radio telescope. Each radio telescope, like the one in the ALMA in Chile, at the Altacoma Desert. We dropped it. It consists of a whole bunch of individual 60-foot diameter dishes which can be moved on railroad tracks. So to correct the phase within their own site is a pretty big mathematical problem. But now you take the phase correction between that site and a site in California and a site in Australia and so on, and a site in Europe. Very complicated to do that across all of that bandwidth with all of that three-dimensional motion going on of the Earth in its orbit around the Sun. That's one motion. That's a complicated elliptical orbit. The Earth itself rotating on its axis with its kinds of wobble. You've got to take all of the stuff back out to a very small fraction of a millimeter of accuracy across the intercontinental distances. So mathematically take that all out and make it all phase match so you get a coherent picture out of this thing. That's those words roll off the tongue easily. To really do that is quite a stretch. Guarantee there's going to be some bugs in the beginning. But once they get this thing to fly, there's a zillion targets out there that you'd like to see with that kind of resolution. There's all kinds of theories as to... Let me drop this. All kinds of theories as to what the surface of a black hole will look like and all the stuff that's circling that black hole, what it looks like. And how would you like to also look at... a pulsar, a neutron star, a quasi-stellar object, and so on. There's all kinds of things out there that are hidden by local dust, and that with high resolution you can see it at millimeter wave frequencies that penetrate that dust. Guarantee you're going to see things that you never expected. So once you iron the bugs out of this experiment, I think this could become as significant as some of our major great big telescopes. Like this could become as significant as the infrared telescope that's going to be launched in the end of next year, is it? Why can't I think of the name of that one? You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, the James Webb Space Telescope, $8 billion. But well spent, this is work. Now, you've got, I guess it would be a 2,000 or 3,000 mile. No, wait, more than that. It's going to be diameter of the Earth is 8,000, so probably what, 4,000 mile diameter antenna is really what they're trying to duplicate. I guess that would be a lot more effective than, say, the 1,000-foot Arecibo. That new one in China, I think it's 1,500 feet diameter. So, you know, maybe they should look for the hydrogen frequency was 1.4 something or other. Looks a little green men signal. One of they would give that a try. Point that, let's say, at a densely populated area. Maybe the Milky Way is a lot of stars there. Maybe they'll be able to pick up a signal. What do you think, Dick?
Yeah, the hydrogen line is at 1420 megahertz. The natural free hydrogen molecule emits that frequency in the some of the early radio telescopes were tuned to that frequency in order to find out where are all the hydrogen clouds in the universe. But once this thing is perfected, boy, there's a lot of targets out there you could be looking at. After they finish looking at that black hole, I think some of the next targets you want to look at will be some of the nearby exoplanets. To see the planet itself with millimeter waves, well, let me think about that. You still have the problem of the local star emits tremendously powerful optical frequencies as well as millimeter wave frequencies. So James Webb, because the James Webb has got a mirror that's so many wavelengths in diameter, you stand a chance of having enough sharpness of beamwidth that you can look at the exoplanet at the same time that the star itself, that the exoplanet is going around, is off to one side of the main lobe and hopefully being rejected by, 80 dB or so. And there's various ways you can create a notch in the antenna pattern in the direction of that particular star. Let me drop it. Make believe that a headlight of an automobile is aimed at you, and crawling across the edge of that headlight is a mosquito. And with your telescope, you want to look at that mosquito. A mosquito is a dark object, in front of a very bright object. That's approximately what you're trying to do when you look at an exoplanet that's going around another star that's a long distance away. So you need a lot of angular resolution, and you also need the ability to block the light from the star itself. The general instrument that does that is called a coronagraph. You can get a sharper and sharper notch of greater and greater depth in a coronagraph when the blocking object in that direction is just the right shape and further away from the center of your telescope. There's been a couple of projections lately about a telescope that we're eventually going to make where the hold-on telescope is in space, and the actual blocking object that blocks out the local star that we're looking at of that exoplanet will be some number of miles, maybe even hundreds of miles, away from the telescope. To set a blocking object out there, an opaque object of just the right size, just the right shape, in just the right position, when you do that correctly, you can block that star, the overpowering light from the star, and now look at the planet. And when you can look at the planet with high resolution, you can start resolving what gases are in its atmosphere, how bright is it, how big is it, how fast is it turning, and so on. So, things that we call telescopes, let me drop it. Whether the telescope is operating at ultraviolet, visible, near-infrared, far-far-infrared, which you and I call millimeter waves, millimeter wave and submillimeter wave. When you look at all of that spectrum with all the right kind of modern-day hardware, you're going to get finer and finer resolution of whatever your target is out there. And with that extra resolution, you'll eventually be able to find out. It would be nice to dream that you can look at the city of the people who live on a planet that's going around some other star. It would be nice to dream about that. That's too far ahead. But it's not out of the question. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, just leaving a space for anybody that wanted to jump in. The mission you're talking about where they're going to put that shield out, they want to make that, I forgot how big it's supposed to be. It's as big as a stadium. Like as big as a Super Bowl. Superdome. Want to launch this thing on two different rockets, like two SpaceX heavy rockets. Talking about that, where you know, it's a big heavy thing. It's going to unfold miles and miles in front of the actual telescope, and then the actual telescope will be launched by another SpaceX rocket and put into operation, and then these two things would work together. And the thing that unfolds, it's going to unfold like an origami type of thing. You know, it's one of these complex contraptions that's going to unfold. And it's not going to be a big disc. You know, instead of one big circle on the circumference, you're going to have a lot of points. And it has to do with changing the way the light comes across. One to try to diffuse the light along the whole circumference so that the camera would work better. But we'll see what happens on that. Let me drop it. As far as looking at the planets, I don't know if you guys, I dropped it long enough. One sec. As far as looking at the planets with the James Webb Space Telescope, they think they'll be able to see the planets. Strong possibility. Some of the close ones. For instance, it has a spectroscope on it. So it's an infrared telescope. They're going to have a spectrometer hooked up to it. And as the planet goes in front of the star, and they'll know which planet to look at because they've already been picked up by Kepler and different other methods. The planet goes in front of the star, and the star is giving off light. And the light, as it goes through, you know, past the planet, planet has an atmosphere, let's say it has methane in it, which would be like a possible good sign of, you know, of life or oxygen. They say James Webb will be able to pick up those signs through the through spectro- through the spectroscope on board. So that's pretty good. This thing better work. I've been listening to the James Webb Space Telescope for 20 years. They used to call it the, it was called the New Generation Telescope 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. Back to you, Dick. WS Plank.
I wonder if they renamed it more than once. In the case of that space-mounted coronagraph, where in theory it's going to have the ability to thoroughly block the light coming from a star that has a planet going around it, and from our distance, a zillion light years away, those two objects are extremely close to each other. So to get enough resolution to block that star, you've got to have that that blocking object very far away. And the reason why it's got that crazy perimeter shape with all those points is because you would think when you're blocking a star, you would just use an opaque disk of material. Well, the sharp edge around the disk of material would be creating optical knife edge diffraction. In other words, some of the light going around that disk would be crawling around that edge. Let me drop this. One of the experiments that a number of optical telescope builders have done is to shine a bright light behind a razor blade in a dark room. When you do that, you'll see that the sharp edge of the razor blade glows. The light crawls around that edge, knife edge diffraction. It happens at radio frequencies, it happens at optical frequencies. So Mother Nature doesn't like a sharp discontinuity. We've got a completely opaque object and all of a sudden there's nothing there around that sharp edge. So you have to gradually taper the amount of light coming around that edge. That's why that crazy shape, that star shape, exists. And when you do it just right, you don't get that knife edge diffraction. Or you do get a little bit of it, but the light that's scattered by that complicated shape is so widely scattered that it doesn't glow in the dark anymore, so to speak. It doesn't give you the interference you're worried about. So with that exotic origami folded thing positioned the right number of miles in front of your telescope in exactly the right position, you can now look at an exoplanet without being blinded by the local star. That's what a coronagraph does. And so that's going to be an interesting experiment. I don't remember reading when they intend to firstly launch one of those. Is it right now something that's on the drawing board that hasn't yet been approved of, Paul, that you know? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, a lot of these things get on the drawing board, but nobody's willing to pay for it yet. Like that rocket that Orbital ATK is going to build, that massive rocket that I mentioned before, the next generation launch system. Again, they don't even have a name for that yet. But that's been on the drawing board. They've been working on it. But it wasn't funded. Now NASA's going to fund it. So with them, you know, money behind them and their own money, they're going to develop that. And it's actually a takeoff of another system that they had planned called the Liberty. Liberty was another similar type of thing, but, you know, different engines, different everything. But, you know, these things evolve as years go on. But it is going to be assembled in the VAB building, the Vehicle Assembly Building, the same one that they built the shuttle in and the Saturn V and now the SLS, the Space Launch System. They're going to take one of the bays, Orbital ATK is going to take that and build the next generation launch system when we drop it. So, I mean, Liberty was one way back. I mean, they had a planned manned vehicle that was going to be part of that, but that was all canceled. And right now, this is not going to be manned. You know, I would imagine it has the future capability. And it will be rolled out to, they'll probably use the mobile crawler, and it will be rolled out to Launch Complex 39B, utilizing the same launch complex that the NASA SLS Space Launch System, you know, the future Moon and Mars rocket will be using. But they'll all be launching, you know, maybe once a year or so on the SLS, which will leave Launch Complex 39B available for other uses. The orbital ATK will make that use, you know, for this large rocket. 39A is already taken over by SpaceX, which is an identical launch facility to 39B. But as far as telescopes go, yeah, I think you're big on the telescopes. Turn it back to you if you have any more info on those scopes that you plan on putting into space. There's quite a few of them. There's going to be a lot more.
Yeah, obvious by the success of Hubble, a space-mounted telescope can give you an awful lot of visibility you've never had before, awful lot of resolution. By way of adaptive optics, the telescopes that are on the ground that have to look through the atmosphere, at least on the frequencies where the atmosphere is reasonably transparent, the twinkle of the stars by adaptive optics, most of that can be taken out. And so, although you don't have as much clarity of atmosphere of a ground-based telescope as opposed to a space-based, that's bad news. The good news is you can build a ground-based telescope tens and hundreds of times bigger in mirror size, and therefore you make up an awful lot of the disadvantage. The one disadvantage you can't make up is there are certain frequencies, that certain infrared and ultraviolet frequencies that just will not go through the atmosphere, not even on a clear day. So for those particular wavelengths, you've got to be above the atmosphere. The atmosphere is moderately transparent to millimeter waves. Let me drop that. Because the good news about doing a radio telescope at millimeter waves is that you're looking through the atmosphere just once. You go straight up from the ground through the atmosphere out into space. Although the atmosphere is a little bit opaque, you only go through it once. Whereas if you're doing millimeter wave radio transmission on the ground, where you're going through many miles of atmosphere, then the absorption at millimeter wave frequencies starts piling up real fast. One of the frequencies that ham radio operators, or very few of them, have experimented with is the 243 gigahertz ham radio band. And there, the atmospheric absorption, I forget the exact number, but it's something like 10 decibels per kilometer. Compare that to fiber optics. We can go across the whole Don Atlantic Ocean with about 10 dB of loss due to absorption. But 10 dB per kilometer, I think it's a rough number at 243 gigahertz. So the absorption starts piling up real fast. And so the nice thing about the radio telescope is that it's only looking straight up through the atmosphere once. And you can live with that as long as you don't have to go through a whole lot of miles of it. Let me drop this. Now, what is the latest going on at the launch site in French Guiana, I think it's called, in South America? The last we knew, the people were on strike. Has there been any progress? Are things still on hold because of the disagreement that's going on down there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, everything's on hold. And I know some of the French leaders went there. Offered them, I don't know, 1 billion euros to help their economy. Said no way, they want 3 billion, you know. So, I don't know what's going to happen. Last I heard, the same thing was going on. They were, in fact, they took one of the satellites, big satellites, probably 10,000 pound satellites, that was scheduled to go to French Guiana, and they just sent it right back to the warehouse without even getting on the airplane. You know, they get it on these big airplanes and they ship it down there from Europe. So, you know, they launched three rockets down there. They launched the Ariane 5, you know, the heavy class, and they launched the Soyuz. They buy Soyuz rockets from Russia and drop it. And then they have the Vega rocket that's manufactured by Italy. And that's the one that sent out, you know, they that's a good rocket too. Not only orbital, but, you know, they sent that to an L2 position, one of the spacecraft not too long ago. So that's going to be on hold for a while, I think, until they iron things out. is really good. I mean, it's bad to say, but it's good for SpaceX. Right now, it's one of the only ones that'll launch it on a regular basis. Avis 5 got delayed recently. Cygnus was supposed to go up last month. It's going to go up in about a week or two, but that got delayed. Proton rockets are pretty much grounded. You know, there's been probably 400 proton rockets from Russia that have gone off over the decades. That's grounded. A lot of the upstage rockets have faults in them. So with all these problems, SpaceX is they're going to go full blast here. Back to you, Dick.
Very, very noisy signal. I heard KC2 something. Want to try again? K2RIW? Okay, that signal is very low in audio, very low in RF, 85% noise, 15% audio, and I heard KC2 something like YOG. Is there anything you can do to give us a little more signal and a little more audio? Back to you, sir. K2RIW. I just barely heard KC2. It sounds like YLG. Yankee Lima Golf is what I think I heard. Go ahead.
I heard Westchester.
Okay, Westchester. You're giving us a signal that's now it's running 90% noise, 10% audio. Go ahead.
The best I can do right now. If I'm not getting through, I'll try and come back next week.
That transmission, whatever you did, you made it. You gave us more audio, and now we can copy you. Go right ahead with your question or comment, and start with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Hi, Steve. I left your ear from a beautiful time interesting list from a friend from a radar satellite state showing something quite interesting from a few days ago. If you're near a computer, I can give you the address, but I'd love to get your opinion on this.
Okay, you want to give us a computer address and get our opinion on it, Steve. Go ahead, try. Louder and your signal got much, much weaker. Essentially, none of that was copyable that time, Steve. All I can tell is you were saying X-ray in there a couple of times. That's all I could hear. Sorry to say. So, either the propagation between you and the repeater is going up and down, or a noise source of some kind is coming up and down. So, we're really not getting anything except intermittently. The second to the last transmission of yours came through quite well. That was the only one that came through quite well when you told me your name was Steve. K2RIW listening.
Okay, I'm standing closer to a window now. Is it any better?
Fantastically better. I now realize you're on a handy-talkie. And the thing you got to worry about is that when you move around the room with your handy-talkie, so you get the best signal on reception, that is not necessarily the best position for transmission, because they're on two different frequencies, if you know what I mean. Okay, near the window, we're hearing you. Go ahead and try it again, Steve.
Okay, here we go. So the address, the URL is tinyurl.com. That's tinyurl, T-I-N-Y-U-R-L.com, / kilo 36 x-ray 2 Uniform Zulu. So it's tinyurl.com/ K36 X as in X-ray 2 U as in uniform, C as in Zulu.
Okay, that's a good location with your handy talkie. We heard that. When we go to that tiny URL, What are we going to see, Steve? Go ahead.
From what I understand, these are two polar orbiting satellites in space with receivers on 19 gigahertz, 22 gigahertz, and 37 gigahertz. These are microwave receivers that are used by, I guess, by NASA and by the space agencies to detect moisture in the atmosphere. But something really strange was detected by these sensors. I think it's April 2nd. If you look at the animation, you'll see something coming out from the South Pole, from Antarctica, about minus 70 degrees. If you look on the bottom, near the bottom of South America, and you'll see what seems to be a very powerful RF microwave signal. Of Antarctica and shooting all the way up until Asia, and this signal is there for a while. It looks powerful. Do you see?
So, at 19, 22, and 37 gigahertz, they're looking at water vapor or moisture in the atmosphere with this polar satellite, and you're saying something at 70 degrees near the South Pole, some anomalous signal is coming up from the ground. Is that what you're saying, Steve? Go ahead.
Yeah, that is correct. And if you look at the animation, around April 2nd, you will see what looks like a signal, a very powerful signal, come through. And you can even see the wavelength of the signal. So I was hoping maybe you can take a look, and maybe by measuring the wavelength, you can even tell us what the frequency is, or maybe you can tell us what this might be, if you've ever seen anything, if you've ever seen anything like this before, Dick.
Okay, I've got a computer fairly nearby. I can try loading that tiny URL. At your operating position, you don't have a computer right there, do you, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
WS2N, I tried it the first time. No, I'm not getting it. I probably copied it wrong. I copied www.tinyurl.com 36 X-ray 2 Uniform Zulu. I don't know if that's right.
You got it almost right. Right after the tinyurl.com /Kilo 36 X-ray 2 Uniform Zulu. Over to you, Paul.
Okay. tinyurl. Let's try that one more time. /Kilo. All right, we'll try that. No, I'm doing something wrong. Now I got www.tinyurl.com/Kilo 36 X-ray 2 Uniform Zulu.
You might want to take off the www. It's just tinyurl.com without the www.
Give that a go, Paul.
No, I got. Listen, wait. One second. What am I doing? No. tinyurl.com/kilo. KILO. 36 X-ray 2 Uniform Zulu. That's not right, Steve.
When I say kilo, I just mean the letter K. So it's the letter K, the numbers 36, the letter X, the number 2, and the letters U and Z. Uniform Zulu.
AC2IS coming.
Okay, I'm seeing a moving map of the Earth. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I was basically just going to say what you just said. It looks like a map of the Earth with some swirling heat map, weather pattern. It's a very nice animation, but I'm not sure what we're supposed to learn from it. AC2IS.
Now that I've got that moving map on my screen, Steve, what part of that moving map am I supposed to look at? I think you said just below South America or just above the South Pole. There's something unusual. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Right below South America, right around April 2nd. Okay, I think this is clear. If you look at the date, right around where it says negative, minus 70 longitude, if you watch carefully, you'll see a signal come out of that area and propagate all the way going up until Asia. And, you know, it's clearly an RF signal that's from there, and you can even see the wavelength.
What's the date in which you're seeing this unusual signal, Steve?
It's about April 1st. April 1st, maybe 5 UTC, 8 UTC. Right when it switches to April 1st is when you'll see something moving from that area. And it's going to head northeast. Sorry, can Dick?
I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be looking for. There was a period of time where there was a whole bunch of spikes that go across the whole darn picture for about 2 seconds. That's not what you're talking about?
No. What I'm talking about will happen right when the date switches to April 1st, and it'll be coming directly from below South America, right below the tip, right where it says minus 70. If you look right in that area, halfway through the animation, you should see something. It looks like a signal, some kind of wave, will jump out of that area.
I see it. I'm sure it's fine. I see it.
I'm not convinced that that's real, Steve. That could be an artifact of their processing technique. That might not be real.
It's April 1st. It might be April Fool's.
Okay, I mean, it might be April Fool's. I'm not sure if the government would play that kind of game, but this is real. This is real. What's going to
happen? AC2IS, comment.
Go ahead, Bill. What do you see?
I believe he's referring to the sine wavy looking thing that propagates across the map in white. And I believe what that is an area that was not imaged for whatever reason. AC2IS.
I think you're right, Bill. I think it's an artifact, as they call it, of the recording and processing technique. I'm not convinced that that's a real signal. But this overall picture, how did you find it, Steve? How did you know to look there? Over to you, Steve, K2IW.
I have a friend that monitors this and a few other satellites, and apparently this is extremely rare. It's only happened one or two times in the past, I don't know, 5-6 years. It's extremely rare. So if this was a visual artifact, it would probably happen much more often, but apparently it's extremely rare.
Now that we're hearing you very well, Steve, are your call letters Kilo Charlie 2 Yankee, Yankee something Golf, go ahead. Steve, what are your call letters? Paul, have you had any luck of finding that website?
Yeah, I see what he's saying, yeah. And I see the screen flashing with the, like a little sine wave coming out of South Argentina, going up into the South Pacific. But because it's April 1st, I gotta believe it's somebody put that in there. Gotta be. My birthday's April 1st. Back to you, Dick.
Were you able to copy Steve's call letters?
No, I didn't. And if he's on an HT, his battery might have quit. But at that time, his reception was very bad.
Okay, we'll have to spend a little more time looking at this. Let me think now. So, what is the major complaint in South America? Are they complaining about living conditions, salary, chain of command, what they're being ordered to do? What do you believe is the major complaint that's hanging things up? And it looks like what's going on at the Kennedy Space Center is the major fallback for the time being, when we have to do without South America. Over to you, Paul.
Well, yeah, there's other locations for heavy lift vehicles. Russia, well, actually Kazakhstan and part of Russia. Northern part of Russia has a launch facility. China has a large lift vehicle. In fact, they'll be putting up their space station, third portion of their space station probably within a year or two. They're sending up a Progress type ship, cargo ship to the space station that's up there now. So they, you know, there's launches in here as the their heavy launch vehicle, and so there's other locations, but United States, of course, we're number one, and it has the problems in French Guiana is looks like unemployment to me, high unemployment. Economy is based around the airport and the spaceport, but you know it's been up and running since the late 1960s. So you know you've got population explosion to some degree in that area, and now you know you have all these people running around with hardly any jobs. So it's become a problem. The hospitals are far and few between, so they need better living conditions overall throughout the country. From what I've been reading, thanks.
Now, I'm guaranteeing that the spaceport and the airport employ a lot of people. They've employed a lot of people for decades. If for some reason, have they gone over to greater automation and they've employed less people recently? Is that why there's unemployment? Or is there something else in the economy that's aggravating the condition that's not part of the space operation? Over you, Paul.
Well, I think like anywhere else, you know, you have generation that's coming up that wasn't there. You know, they were born there. So you have a larger population growth, and without anything else besides the spaceport, maybe I think two airports, I think you're going to wind up with unemployment. That's my guess. You know, I'm just trying to find out myself, but that's the way it looks. So people are unhappy. Whether or not they resolve this anytime soon, I don't know. One article I said, it looks like it's going to be over soon. And another one says they don't. So, you know, you got to go figure. We'll see. We have enough stuff to keep us worried about our own country to keep it going. They finally wind up in trouble. I mean, they've been launching rockets there on a regular basis for decades. They did have a problem, I think, some years ago, but then they resolved it. One other thing I wanted to talk about just real quick, Dick, before I forget. The International Space Station, it looks like they're talking now between the Russians and NASA. Russian group is called Roscosmos. That's the equivalent of NASA over there. Looks like they're getting together to try to extend the life of the International Space Station another 4 years. It's been set already to 2024 through the Obama administration. They got everybody to sign on. They got Russia to sign on. They got European Space Agency to sign on. And then Japan also signed on. JAXA, the JAXA, that's their NASA. Up until 2024. Now it looks like the Russians and the United States are definitely pushing for 2028, at least 2028. So that's a good sign. Keep it going. Back to you.
Considering the billions of dollars, you've told me once before, I'm going to ask you again, roughly how many billions of dollars of European, Russian, and American money have been put into the International Space Station. Certainly don't want that to go dead. That's a very big investment of man hours, hardware, dollars. So to keep it operational makes a lot of sense. The thing that scares me is that it's such a large object, which represents a very big target, and whenever I see a demonstration of what it's like inside the International Space Station, you see a cosmonaut or an astronaut literally flying through space from one end to the other, and it looks like he's going through 100 yards of total length. And many of those portals between the individual modules have got various things that are bridging the portal, an air vent or cables and so on. If a sudden piece of space junk came along and pierced the wall anywhere along that length, and the air starts running out, considering how many of those portals that don't look like they can be closed, I think they would have an awful lot of trouble in a hurry saving the system. Now, I'd like to believe, let me drop quick, that all the tracking that has been done, they've kept track of every particle in orbit that's capable of giving them grief. However, what's the size of the minimum, what's the minimum size of things that they can resolve from the ground? Something the size of a 1/4-20 nut and bolt, which maybe is too small to resolve from the ground. If that had a direct hit with the side of one of those modules, particularly if it hit a window, I think it could knock a big enough hole and that air would come rushing out of there pretty darn fast. I believe the space station operates at 14.7 pounds per square inch, in which case the air would come running out of there awfully fast. So to convert the system to a safe mode, if they do get a hole somewhere in it, I wonder how much backup procedures have been invented for that particular event. Over to you for any comments on that, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, first of all, the cost for the United States, total cost so far, I think, was $67 billion. And total cost for the space station itself is just over $100 billion. And the annual budget, well, the annual budget average for NASA has been like $18 or $19 billion, you know, for all of NASA per year over the last few years. Out of that, about $3 billion go to, I think it's $3 billion, goes to International Space Station, and most of that really not to maintain the station itself, but that has to do with crews, you know, paying the Russians. To give you an idea, one Russian seat, if we put an American on board, roughly around $80 million now. So, but the cost of all, you know, all that, probably about $3 billion a year. So that's the cost. As far as the pressure on board, it's 14.7 pounds. And yeah, it's about, not 300 feet, but about, what, it's close, probably about 250 feet from one end to the other, I think. Let me drop it. You know, including the Soyuz spacecraft that's sticking off the end of it, probably about that far. And I know at least once a year or so they have, or maybe more, NORAD will give them a warning that something's coming close. And they just abandon everything and they head over to the Soyuz spacecraft. You know, so if you have six people or nine people on board, one point they had nine people on board with three Soyuz spacecraft attached, or whatever it might be. You know, they head to the Soyuz spacecraft. They had a lifeboat. And they'll sit there and wait for the event to pass, and then they go back. But if, you know, if the space station can sit, automatically undock and head home. That's about all they can do. As far as closing doors and all, I don't know. Maybe there's a door or something that the last guy threw heading to the back of the space station in an emergency. Maybe he closes one of the doors. I don't know. Back to the WS one.
I believe it was a Russian Progress ship that became poorly controlled during one of the docking maneuvers, crashed into the side of either a Mir or the ISS, I forget which it was, and a leak was created. Which spacecraft did that occur on? And has that module just simply been closed off? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, that was in the 1990s on Mir. They were practicing bringing a Progress ship in the cosmonaut would be inside the space station, and he was practicing